This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Ghost Story by Peter Straub, performed by Buck Scherner. For Vali Shayo and Gregorio Kohan. The chasm was merely one of the orifices of that pit of blackness that lies beneath us, everywhere. The Marble Faun, Nathaniel Hawthorne. Ghosts are always hungry. R.D. Jameson. Prologue. Driving South. 1. What was the worst thing you've ever done? I won't tell you that, but I'll tell you the worst thing that ever happened to me, the most dreadful thing. 2. Because he thought that he would have problems taking the child over the border into Canada, he drove south, skirting the cities whenever they came, and taking the anonymous freeways, which were like a separate country, as travel was itself like a separate country. The sameness both comforted and stimulated him, so that on the first day he was able to drive for 20 hours straight through. They ate at McDonald's and at root beer stands. When he was hungry, he left the freeway and took a state highway parallel to it, knowing that a drive-in was never more than 10 or 20 miles away. Then he woke up the child, and they both gnawed at their hamburgers or chili dogs, the child never speaking more than to tell him what she wanted. Most of the time, she slept. That first night, the man remembered the light bulbs illuminating his license plates, and though this would later prove to be unnecessary, swung off the freeway onto a dark country road long enough to unscrew the light bulbs and toss them into a field. Then he took handfuls of mud from beside the road and smeared them over the plates. Wiping his hands on his trousers, he went back around to the driver's side and opened the door. The child was sleeping with her back straight against the seat, her mouth closed. She appeared to be perfectly composed. He still did not know what he was going to have to do to her. In West Virginia, he came awake with a jerk and realized that for some seconds he had been driving in his sleep. "We're going to pull up and take a nap." He left the freeway outside of Clarksburg and drove on a state road until he saw against the sky a red revolving sign with the words "Pioneer Village" on it in white. He was keeping his eyes open only by willpower. His mind did not feel right. It seemed that tears were hanging just behind his eyes, and that very soon he would involuntarily begin to weep. Once in the parking lot of the shopping center, he drove to the row farthest from the entrance and backed the car up against a wire fence. Behind him was a square brick factory which manufactured plastic animal replicas for display. For golden chicken trucks. The factory's asphalt yard was half filled with giant plastic chickens and cows. In their midst stood a giant blue ox. The chickens were unfinished, larger than the cows and dully white. Before him lay this nearly empty section of the lot, then a thick cluster of cars in rows, and then the series of low, sandstone-colored buildings, which was the shopping center.
"Can we look at the big chickens?" the girl asked.
He shook his head. "We're not getting out of the car, we're just going to sleep." He locked the doors and rolled up the windows. Under the child's steady, unexpectant gaze, he bent over, felt under the seat, and drew out a length of rope. "Hold your hands out," he said. Almost smiling, she held out her small hands, balled into fists. He pulled them together and wound the rope twice about her wrists, knotted it, and then tied her ankles together. When he saw how much rope was left, he held out the surplus with one arm and roughly pulled the child to him with the other. Then he wound the rope about them both, looping them together, and made the final knot after he had stretched out across the front seat. She was lying on top of him, her hands bunched in the middle of his stomach and her head on his chest. She breathed easily and regularly, as if she had expected no more than what he had done. The clock on the dashboard said that it was 5:30, and the air was just beginning to turn cooler. He hitched his legs forward and leaned his head back against the headrest. To the noises of traffic, he fell asleep. And awakened, it seemed, immediately, his face filmed with sweat, the faintly acrid, greasy odor of the child's hair in his nostrils. It was dark now. He must actually have slept for hours. They had gone undiscovered. Imagine being found in a shopping center parking lot in Clarksburg, West Virginia, with a little girl tied to your sleeping body. He groaned, shifted himself to one side, and woke the girl. Like him, she came immediately into wakefulness. She bent back her head and regarded him. There was no fear, only intensity in her gaze. He hurriedly untied the knots, dragged the rope from around them. His neck complained when he sat upright. "You want to go to the bathroom?" he asked. She nodded.
"Where?"
"Beside the car."
"Right here? In the parking lot?"
"You heard me." He thought again that she nearly smiled. He looked at the girl's intense, small face framed in black hair.
"You'll let me?"
"I'm going to be holding onto your hand."
"But you won't look."
For the first time, she showed concern. He shook his head. She moved her hand to the lock on her door, but he shook his head again and took her wrist and held it tightly. "Out on my side," he said, and pulled up his own lock and got out, still clutching the girl's bony wrist. She began to edge sideways toward the door. A girl of 7 or 8 with short black hair, wearing a little dress of some thin pink material. On her otherwise bare feet were faded blue canvas sneakers, fraying at the tops of the heels. Childishly, she put one bare leg down first, and then wiggled around to swing the other out of the car. He pulled her around to the factory fence. The girl bent her head back and looked up.
"You promised you won't watch."
"I won't watch," he said. And for a moment he did not watch, but let his head roll back as she stooped, forcing him to lean sideways. His eyes drifted over the grotesque plastic animals behind the fence. Then he heard some fabric, cotton, moving over skin and looked down. Her left arm was extended so that she was as far from him as she could get. The cheap pink dress was pulled up over her waist. She, too, was looking at the plastic animals. When the girl was finished, he took his eyes from her, knowing that she would glance at him. She stood up and waited for him to tell her what to do next. He pulled her back toward the car.
"What do you do for a living?" she asked.
He laughed out loud with surprise, this cocktail party question. "Nothing."
"Where are we going? Are you taking me someplace?"
He opened the door and stood aside as she climbed back into the car.
"Someplace," he said.
"Sure, I'm taking you someplace." He got in beside her and she moved across the seat to the door.
"Where?"
"We'll see when we get there." Again, he drove all night, and again the girl slept most of the time, coming awake to stare out the windshield. She always slept sitting up, like a doll in her tennis shoes and pink dress, and to ask him odd questions.
"Are you a policeman?"
she asked him once, and then after seeing an exit sign.
"What's Columbia?"
"It's a city."
"Like New York?"
"Yes."
"Like Clarksburg?"
He nodded.
"Are we always going to sleep in the car?"
"Not always."
Can I play the radio?
He said yes, and she leaned forward and twisted the knob. The car was invaded by static, two or three voices speaking at the same time. She punched another button, and the same crowded hiss erupted from the speaker. Twist the dial, he said. Frowning, her face concentrated, she began slowly to turn the selector. In a moment she had locked onto a clear signal, Dolly Parton.
I love this, she told him.
So for hours they drove south through the songs and rhythms of country music, the stations weakening and changing, the disc jockeys swapping names and accents, the sponsors succeeding each other in a revolving list of insurance companies, toothpaste, soap, Dr. Pepper and Pepsi-Cola, acne preparations, funeral parlors, petroleum jelly, bargain wristwatches, aluminum siding, dandruff shampoos. But the music remained the same, a vast and self-conscious story, a sort of seamless, repetitious epic in which women married truckers and no-good gamblers but stood by them until they got a divorce, and then the men sat in bars, plotting seductions and how to get back home, and they came together hot as $2 pistols and parted in disgust and worried about the babies. Sometimes the car wouldn't start. Sometimes the TV was busted. Sometimes the bars closed down and threw out onto the street, your pockets turned inside out. There was nothing that was not banal. There was no phrase that was not a cliché. But the child sat there satisfied and passive, dozing off to Willie Nelson and waking up to Loretta Lynn, and the man just drove, distracted by this endless soap opera of America's bottom dogs. Once he asked her, "Have you ever heard of a man named Edward Wanderley?" She did not reply, but regarded him lovely. "Have you?"
"Who's he?"
"He was my uncle," he said, and the girl smiled at him. "How about a man named Sears James?" She shook her head, still smiling. "A man named Ricky Hawthorne?" Again she shook her head. There was no point in continuing. He did not know why he had bothered to ask in the first place. It was even possible that she had never heard of those names. Of course, she had never heard them. Still in South Carolina, he thought that a highway patrolman was following him. The police car was 20 yards behind, keeping the same distance whatever the man did. He thought he could see the state cop speaking into his radio. Immediately, he cut his speed by 5 miles an hour and changed lanes, but the police car would not pass. He felt a deep trembling in his chest and abdomen. He visualized the police car gaining on him, turning on its siren, forcing him to the side of the road. Then the questions would begin. It was about 6 in the afternoon and the freeway was crowded. He felt himself being drawn helplessly along with the traffic, at the mercy of whoever was in the police car, helpless, trapped. He had to think. He was simply being drawn on toward Charleston, pulled by the traffic through miles of flat, scrubby country. Suburbs were always visible in the distance, miserable collections of little houses with frame garages. He could not remember the number of the freeway he was on. In the rear-view mirror, behind the long row of cars, behind the police car, an old truck sent out a tall column of black smoke through a chimney-like pipe beside the engine. He feared the patrolman cruising up beside him and shouting, "Get over!" And he could imagine the girl shouting, her high, tinny voice shouting,
"He made me come with him! He ties me onto him when he sleeps!"
The southern sun seemed to assault his face, to grind at his pores. The state patrolman swung out into the next lane and began to draw up toward him.
"Asshole, that's not your girl. Who is that girl?"
Then they would put him in a cell and begin to beat him, working on him methodically with nightsticks, turning his skin purple. But none of that happened. 3. Shortly after 8 o'clock, he pulled over to the side of the road. It was a narrow country road, loose red dirt piled on the shoulders, as if it had been only recently dug out of the earth. He was no longer sure of what state he was in, South Carolina or Georgia. It was as though these states were fluid, as if they and all the rest of them could leak over into one another, pushing forward like the highways. It all looked wrong. He was in the wrong place. No one could live here. No one could think here in this brutal landscape. Unfamiliar vines, green and rope-like, struggled up the low bank beside his car. The fuel gauge had been on E for the past half hour. All of it was wrong. All of it. He looked at the girl, this girl he had kidnapped. She was sleeping in that doll-like way, her back straight against the seat and her feet in the ripped sneakers dangling above the floor. She slept too much. Suppose she was sick. Suppose she was dying. She woke as he was watching her.
"I have to go to the bathroom again," she said.
"Are you okay? You're not sick, are you?"
"I have to go to the bathroom."
"Okay," he grunted and moved to open his door.
"Let me go by myself. I won't run away. I won't do anything. I promise."
He looked at her serious face, her black eyes set in olive skin.
"Where could I go, anyhow? I don't even know where I am."
"I don't either."
"So?"
It had to happen sometime. He couldn't hold on to her at every moment. "You promise?" he asked, knowing the question was foolish. She nodded. He said, "All right."
"And you promise you won't drive away?"
"Yes." She opened the door and left the car. It was all he could do not to watch her, but it was a test not to watch her. A test. He wished overwhelmingly that he had her hand trapped in his fist. She could be scrambling up the bank, running off, screaming. But no, she was not screaming. It often happened that the terrible things he imagined, the worst things, did not occur. The world gave a hitch, and things went back to the way they had always been. When the girl climbed back into the car, he was flooded with relief. It had happened again. No black hole had opened up for him. He closed his eyes and saw an empty freeway divided by white lines unreeling before him. "I have to find a motel," he said. She leaned back into the seat, waiting for him to do whatever he wanted. The radio was turned low, and sounds from a station in Augusta, Georgia, a silky, lilting guitar, drifted out. For a moment, an image leaped to his mind. The girl dead, her tongue protruding, her eyes bulging. She gave him no resistance. Then, for a moment, he was standing. It was as if he were standing on a street in New York, some street in the East 50s, one of those streets where well-dressed women walk sheepdogs. Because there was one of those women walking along, tall, wearing beautifully faded jeans and an expensive shirt and a deep tan, walking along toward him with her sunglasses pushed to the top of her head. A huge sheepdog padded beside her, wagging its rump. He was nearly close enough to see the freckles exposed by the undone top buttons of the woman's shirt. Ah! But then he was right again. He heard the low guitar music, and before he switched on the ignition, he patted the top of the girl's head. "Have to get us a motel," he said. For an hour, he just continued, protected by the cocoon of numbness, by the mechanics of driving. He was almost alone on the dark road.
"Are you going to hurt me?"
the girl asked. "How should I know?"
"You won't, I think. You're my friend."
Then it was not as if he were on the street in New York. He was, on that street, watching the woman with the dog and the suntan come toward him. Again he saw the little random scattering of freckles below her collarbone. He knew how it would taste if he put his tongue there. As often in New York, he could not see the sun, but he could feel it, a heavy, aggressive sun. The woman was a stranger, unimportant. He was not supposed to know her. She was just a type. A taxi went by. He was aware of iron railings on his right side, the lettering on the windows of a French restaurant on the other side of the street. Through the soles of his boots, the pavement sent up heat. Somewhere above, a man was shouting one word over and over. He was there. He was. A portion of his emotion must have shown in his face, for the woman with the dog looked at him curiously, and then hardened her face and moved to the outer edge of the sidewalk. Could she speak? Could someone, in whatever sort of experience this was, utter sentences? Audible, ordinary human sentences? Could you talk to the people you met in hallucinations? And would they answer back? He opened his mouth.
I have to.
To get out, he was going to say. But he was already back in the stalled car. A soggy lump that had once been two potato chips lay on his tongue. What was the worst thing you've ever done? The maps seemed to show that he was only a few miles from Valdosta. He drove unthinkingly on, not daring to look at the child and therefore not knowing if she were awake or sleeping, but feeling her eyes on him nonetheless. Eventually he passed a sign which informed him that he was 10 miles from the friendliest city in the south. It looked like any southern town. A little industry on the way in, machine shops and die stampers, surreal groups of corrugated metal huts under arc lights, yards littered with cannibalized trucks. Further in, wooden houses in need of paint, groups of black men standing on corners, their faces alike in the dark. New roads went scarring through the land, then ended abruptly, weeds already encroaching. In the town proper, the teenagers patrolling endlessly, vacantly in their old cars. He passed a low building, incongruously new, a sign of the New South, with a sign reading, Palmetto Motor Inn. He reversed down the street, back to the building. A girl with upswept, lacquered hair and candy-pink lipstick gave him a meaningless, dead smile and a room with twin beds. For myself and my daughter. In the register he wrote, Lamar Burgess, 155 Ridge Road, Stonington, Connecticut. After he handed her a night's payment in cash, she gave him a key. Their cubicle contained two single beds, an iron-textured brown carpet, and lime-green walls. Two pictures, a kitten tilting its head, an Indian looking into a leafy gorge from a clifftop, a television set, a door into a blue-tiled bathroom. He sat on the toilet seat while the girl undressed and got into bed. When he peeked out to check on her, she was lying beneath a sheet with her face to the wall. Her clothes were scattered on the floor. A nearly empty bag of potato chips lay beside her. He ducked back into the bathroom, stripped and got into the shower, which blessed him. For a moment he felt almost as though he were back in his old life, not Lamar Burgess, but Don Wanderley, one-time resident of Bolinas, California, and author of two novels, one of which had made some money. Lover for a time of Alma Mobley, brother to defunct David Wanderley. And there it was. It was no good. He could not get away from it. The mind was a trap. It was a cage that slammed down over you. However he had got to where he was there, stuck there in the Palmetto Motor Inn. He turned off the shower, all traces of the blessing departed. In the little room, only the weak light over his bed to illuminate those ghostly surroundings, he pulled on his jeans and opened his suitcase. The hunting knife was wrapped in a shirt, and he unrolled it so the knife fell out on the bed. Carrying it by the chunky bone handle, he crossed to the girl's bed. She slept with her mouth open. Perspiration gleamed on her forehead. For a long time he sat beside her, holding the knife in his right hand, ready to use it. But this night he could not. Giving up, giving in, he shook her arm until her eyelids fluttered.
"Who are you?" he asked.
"I want to sleep."
"Who are you?"
"Go away, please."
"Who are you? I'm asking, who are you?"
"You know."
"I know."
"You know, I told you."
"What's your name?"
"Angie."
"Angie what?"
"Angie Maul, I told you before."
He held the knife behind his back so that she could not see it.
"I want to sleep,"
she said.
"You woke me up."
She turned her back to him again. Fascinated, he watched sleep settle over her. Her fingertips twitched, her eyelids contracted, her breathing changed. It was as if, to exclude him, she had willed herself to sleep. "Angie. Angela. Angela Maul." It did not sound like the name she had given him when he had first taken her into the car. Minoso? Minorsi? Some name like that, an Italian name, not Maul. He held the knife in both hands, the black bone handle jammed into his naked belly, his elbows out. All he had to do was thrust it forward and jerk it up, using all his strength. In the end, sometime around 3 in the morning, he crossed over to his bed. 4. The next morning before they checked out, she spoke to him while he was looking at the maps.
"You shouldn't ask me those questions."
"What questions?" He had been keeping his back turned at her request as she got into the pink dress, and he suddenly had the feeling that he had to turn around right now to see her. He could see his knife in her hands, though it was back inside the rolled-up shirt, could feel it just beginning to prick his skin. "Can I turn around now?"
"Yeah, sure."
Slowly, still feeling the knife, his uncle's knife, beginning to enter his skin, he turned sideways on the chair. The girl was sitting on her unmade bed, watching him, her intense, unbeautiful face. "What questions?"
"You know."
"Tell me."
She shook her head and would not say any more. "Do you want to see where we're going?" The girl came toward him, not slowly, but measuredly, as if not wishing to display suspicion. "Here," he said, pointing to a spot on the map. "Panama City, in Florida."
"Will we be able to see the water?"
"Maybe."
"And we won't sleep in the car?"
"No."
"Is it far away?"
"We can get there tonight. We'll take this road, this one. See?"
"Uh-huh."
She was not interested. She hung a little to one side, bored and wary. She said,
"Do you think I'm pretty?"
"What's the worst thing that ever happened to you? That you took off your clothes at night beside the bed of a 9-year-old girl? That you were holding a knife? That the knife wanted to kill her?" "No, other things were worse." Not far over the state line and not on the highway he had shown Angie on the map, but on a 2-lane country road, they drew up before a whiteboard building. Buddy's Supplies. "You want to come in with me, Angie?" She opened the door on her side and got out in that childish way, as if she were climbing down a ladder. He held the screen door open for her. A fat man in a white shirt sat like Humpty Dumpty on a counter.
You cheat on your income tax, he said. And you're the first customer of the day. You believe that? 12:30 and you're the first guy through the door. No, he said, bending forward and scrutinizing them. Hell no. You don't cheat, Uncle Sam. You do worse than that. You're the guy killed 4 or 5 people up in Tallahassee the other day. What? He said. I just came in here for some food. My daughter... Gotcha, the man said. I used to be a cop. Allentown, Pennsylvania. 20 years. Bought this place because a man told me I could turn over $100 profit a week. There's a lot of crooks in this world. Anybody comes in, I can tell you what kind of crook they are. And now I got you straight. You're not a killer. You're a kidnapper. No, he felt sweat pouring down his sides. My girl, you can't shit me. 20 years a cop. He began to look frantically around the store for the girl. Finally, he saw her staring gravely at a shelf stocked with jars of peanut butter. Angie, he said. Angie, come on. Hold on, the fat man said. I was just trying to get a rise out of you. Don't flip out or nothing. You want some of that peanut butter, little girl? Angie looked at him and nodded. Well, take one off the shelf and bring it up here. Anything else, mister? Course, if you're Bruno Hauptmann, I'll have to bring you in. I still got my service revolver around somewhere. Knock you flat, I'll tell you that for free. It was, he saw, all a weary mockery. Yet he could scarcely conceal his trembling. Wasn't that something an ex-cop would notice? He turned away toward the aisles and shelves. Hey, listen to this, the man said to his back. If you're in that much trouble, you can just get the hell out of here right now. No, no, he said. I need some things. You don't look much like that girl. Blindly, he began taking things off the shelves. Anything. A jar of pickles, a box of apple turnovers, a canned ham, 2 or 3 other cans he didn't bother to look at. These he took to the counter. The fat man, Buddy, was staring at him suspiciously. He just shook me up a little bit, he said to him. I haven't had much sleep. I've been driving for a couple of days. Invention blessedly descended. I have to take my little girl to her grandmother. She's in Tampa. Angie swiveled around, clutching 2 jars of crunchy peanut butter, and gaped at him as he said this. Tampa, on account of her mother and me, split up, and I have to get a job, get things put together again. Right, Angie? The girl's mouth hung open. Your name, Angie? The fat man asked her. She nodded. This man your daddy? He thought he would fall down.
Now he is, she said.
The fat man laughed.
Now he is? Just like a kid. God damn. You figure out the brain of a kid, you gotta be some kind of genius. All right, nervous, I guess I'll take your money.
Still sitting on the counter, he rang up the purchases by bending to one side and punching the buttons of the register.
He better get some rest. You remind me of about 1 million guys I took into my old station.
Outside, Wanderley said to her, Thanks for saying that.
Saying what?
Pertly, self-assuredly. Then again, almost mechanically, eerily, ticking her head from side to side.
Saying what? Saying what? Saying what?
5. In Panama City, he pulled into the Gulf Glimpse Motor Lodge, a series of shabby brick bungalows around a parking lot. The manager's lodge sat at the entrance, a separate square building like the others, with the exception of a large pane of plate glass behind which, in what must have been oven-like heat, a stringy old man with gold-rimmed glasses and a mesh T-shirt was visible. He looked like
Adolf Eichmann. The severe, inflexible cast of the man's face made Wanderley remember what the ex-policeman had said about himself and the girl. He did not, with his blonde hair and fair skin, look anything like the girl's father. He pulled up before the manager's lodge and left the car, his palms sweaty. But inside, when he said that he wanted a room for himself and his daughter, the old man merely glanced incuriously at the dark-haired child in the car and said,
10:50 a day. Sign the register. You want food? Try to eat more down the road a piece. There's no cooking in the bungalows. You planning on staying more than one night, mister?
He swung the register toward him.
Boswell?
Maybe as long as a week.
Then you'll pay the first two nights in advance.
He counted out $21, and the manager gave him a key.
Number 11, Lucky 11, across the parking lot.
The room had whitewashed walls and smelled of lavatory cleaner. He gave it a perfunctory look around. The same iron carpet, two small beds with clean but worn sheets, a television with a 12-inch screen, two awful pictures of flowers. The room appeared to have more shadows in it than could be accounted for. The girl was inspecting the bed against the side wall.
What's magic fingers? I want to try it. Can I, please?
It probably won't work.
Can I? I want to try it, please.
All right, lie down on it. I have to go out to do some things. Don't leave until I come back. I have to put a quarter in that slot, see? Like this. When I get back, we can eat. The girl was lying on the bed, nodding with impatience, looking not at him but at the coin in his hand. We'll eat when I get back. I'll try to get you some new clothes, too. You can't wear the same things all the time.
Put in the quarter!
He shrugged, pushed the quarter into the slot, and immediately heard a humming noise. The child settled down onto the bed, her arms fully extended, her face tense.
Oh, it's nice.
I'll be back pretty soon, he said, and went back out into the harsh sunlight, and for the first time smelled water. The gulf was a long way off, but it was visible. On the other side of the road he had taken into town, the land abruptly fell off into a wasteland of weeds and rubble at its bottom, bisected by a series of railroad tracks. After the tracks, another disused weedy patch of land ended at a second road which veered off toward a group of warehouses and loading sheds. Beyond this second road was the Gulf of Mexico, gray, lathery water. He walked down the road in the direction of town. On the edge of Panama City, he went into a Treasure Island discount store and bought jeans and two T-shirts for the girl, fresh underwear, socks, two shirts, a pair of khaki trousers, and hush puppies for himself. Carrying two large shopping bags, he emerged from Treasure Island and turned in the direction that was downtown. Diesel fumes drifted toward him. Cars with Keep the Southland Great bumper stickers rolled by. Men in short-sleeved shirts and short gray crew cuts moved along the sidewalks. When he saw a uniformed cop trying to eat an ice cream cone while writing out a parking ticket, he dodged between a pickup truck and a Trailways van and crossed the street. A rivulet of sweat issued from his left eyebrow and ran into his eye. He was calm. Once again, disaster had not happened. He discovered the bus station by accident. It took up half a block, a vast, new-looking building with black glass slits for windows. He thought, Alma Mobley, her mark. Once through the revolving door, he saw a few aimless people on benches in a large, empty space. The people always seen in bus stations, a few young old men with lined faces and complex hairdos, some children racketing around, a sleeping bum, three or four teenage boys in cowboy boots and shoulder-length hair. Another cop was leaning against the wall by the magazine counter. Looking for him? Panic started in him again, but the cop barely glanced at him. He pretended to check the arrivals and departures board before moving with exaggerated carelessness to the men's room. He locked himself into a toilet and stripped. After dressing up to the waist in the new clothes, he left the toilet and washed at one of the sinks. So much grime came off that he washed himself again, splashing water onto the floor and working the green liquid soap deep into his armpits and around the back of his neck. Then he dried himself on the roller and put on one of the new short-sleeved shirts, a light blue shirt with thin red stripes. All of his old clothes went into the Treasure Island bag. Outside, he noticed the odd grainy grayish blue of the sky. It was the sort of sky he imagined as hanging forever over the keys and swamps much further south in Florida. A sky that would hold the heat, doubling and redoubling it, forcing the weeds and plants into fantastic growth, making them send out grotesque and swollen tendrils. The sort of sky and hot disk of sun, which should always, now that he thought of it, have hung over Alma Mobley. He stuffed the bag of old clothes in a trash barrel outside a gun shop. In the new clothes, his body felt young and capable, healthier than it had all through that terrible winter. Wanderley moved down the shabby southern street, a tall, well-built man in his 30s, no longer quite aware of what he was doing. He rubbed his cheek and felt that blond man's feathery stubble. He could go 2 or 3 days without looking as though he needed a shave. A pickup, driven by a sailor, 5 or 6 sailors in summer whites, standing up in the rear of the truck, drove past him, and the sailors yelled something, something cheerful and private and derisory.
"They don't mean no harm," said a man who had appeared beside Wanderley. His head, with an enormous hair-sprouting wart dividing one eyebrow, came no higher than Wanderley's breastbone. "They's all good boys."
He smiled and uttered a meaningless agreement and moved away. He could not go back to the motel, could not deal with the girl. He felt as though he might faint. His feet seemed unreal in the hush puppies, too far down, too far from his eyes. He found that he was walking rapidly down a descending street, going toward an area of neon signs and movie theaters. In the grainy sky, the sun hung high and motionless. Shadows of parking meters stood out, purely black on the sidewalk. For a moment, he was certain there were more shadows than parking meters. All the shadows hovering over the street were intensely black. He passed the entrance to a hotel and was aware of a vast brown empty space, a brown, cool cave beyond its glass doors. Almost unwillingly, recognizing a dread familiar set of sensations, he went on in the terrific heat. Consciously, he kept himself from stepping over the shadows of the parking meters. 2 years before, the world had gathered itself in this ominous way, had been slick and full of intent. After the episode of Alma Mobley, after his brother had died, in some fashion, literally or not, she had killed David Wanderley. He knew that he had been lucky to escape whatever it was that took David through the Amsterdam hotel window. Only writing had brought him back up into the world. Only writing about it. The horrid, complicated mess of himself and Alma and David, writing about it as a ghost story had released him from it. He had thought. Panama City? Panama City, Florida? What was he doing there? And with that strange, passive girl he had taken with him, whom he had spirited down through the South? He had always been the erratic one, the troubled one, the foil to David's strength. In the economy of family life, his poverty, the foil to David's success. His ambitions and pretensions,
You actually think you can support yourself as a novelist? Even your uncle wasn't that dumb. His father. The contrast to David's hard-working good sense, to David's steady progress through law school and into a good law firm. And when David had bumped into the daily stuff of his life, it had killed him. That was the worst thing that had ever happened to him. Until last winter. Until Milburn. The shabby street seemed to open like a grave. He felt as if one more step toward the bottom of the hill and the sleazy movie theaters would take him down, down, as if it would never stop but turn into an endless falling. Something which had not been there before appeared before him, and he squinted to see it more clearly. Breathlessly, he turned around in the piercing sunlight. His elbow caught someone's chest, and he heard himself murmuring, "Sorry, sorry," to an irritated woman in a white sun hat. He unconsciously began to move quickly back up the street. Back there, looking down to the intersection at the bottom of the hill, he had momentarily seen his brother's tombstone. It had been small, of purple marble, the words, "David Webster Wanderley, 1939 to 1975, carved into it, sitting in the middle of the intersection. He fled. Yes, he had seen David's tombstone. But David had none. He had been cremated in Holland, and his ashes flown back to their mother. David's tombstone. Yes, with David's name. But what sent him rushing back up the hill was the feeling that it was for him, and that if he were to kneel in the middle of the intersection and dig up the coffin, within it he would find his own putrefying body. He turned into the only cool, welcoming place he had seen, the hotel lobby. He had to sit down to calm himself. Beneath the disinterested regard of a desk clerk and a girl behind a magazine counter, he sank down onto a sofa. His face was clammy, the fabric of the sofa's upholstery rubbed uncomfortably into his back. He leaned forward, ran his fingers through his hair, looked at his watch. He had to appear normal, as if he were just waiting for someone. He had to stop trembling. Potted palm trees had been placed here and there about the lobby. A fan whirled overhead. A thin old man in a purple uniform stood by an open elevator and stared at him. Caught, he looked away. When noises came to him, he realized that since seeing the tombstone in the middle of the intersection, he had heard nothing. His own pulse had drowned all other sound. Now the efficient noises of hotel life floated in the humid air. A vacuum cleaner hummed on an invisible staircase. Telephones dimly rang. The elevator doors closed with a soft whoosh. Around the lobby, small groups of people sat in conversation. He began to feel that he could face the street again. 6.
"I'm hungry," she said.
"I got you some new clothes."
"I don't want new clothes. I want food."
He crossed the room to sit in the empty chair. "I thought you'd get tired of wearing the same dress all the time."
"I don't care what I wear."
"Okay." He tossed the bag onto her bed. "I just thought you might like them." She did not respond. "I'll feed you if you answer some questions." She turned away from him and began picking at the sheets, wrinkling them and smoothing them out. "What's your name?"
"I told you, Angie."
"Angie Mall?"
"No, Angie Mitchell."
He let it go. "Why haven't your parents sent the police out to find you? Why haven't we been found yet?"
"I don't have any parents."
"Everybody has parents."
"Everybody except orphans."
"Who takes care of you?"
"You do."
"Before me."
"Shut up. Shut up."
Her face became glossy and self-contained. "Are you really an orphan?"
"Shut up. Shut up. Shut up."
To stop her screaming, he lifted the canned ham out of the box of groceries.
All right, he said. I'll get you some food. We'll have some of this.
Okay.
It was as if she had never screamed.
I want the peanut butter, too.
While he was slicing the ham, she said,
Do you have enough money to take care of us?
She ate in her dedicated way. First she bit off a mouthful of ham, then dipped her fingers in the peanut butter and brought a wad of it home and chewed the two together.
Delicious,
she managed to utter around the food.
If I go to sleep, you won't leave, will you?
She shook her head.
But I can take a walk, can I?
I guess so.
He was drinking a can of beer from a six-pack he had picked up at the little store on his way back. The beer and the food together made him drowsy, and he knew that if he did not get to bed, he would fall asleep in the chair. She said,
You don't have to tie me on to you. I'll come back. You believe me, don't you?
He nodded.
Because where could I go? I don't have anywhere to go.
Okay, he said.
Once again, he could not talk to her as he wished. She was in control.
You can go out, but don't be gone too long.
He was acting like a parent. He knew that she had put him in this role. It was ludicrous. He watched her go out of the mean little room. Later, rolling over in bed, he dimly heard the door clicking shut and knew that she had, after all, come back. So she was his. And that night he lay on his bed, fully dressed, watching her sleep. When the muscles began to ache from being held so long in the same position, he shifted his body on the bed. In this way, over a period of 2 hours, he went from lying on his side and supporting his head on his hand to sitting up with his knees raised and his hands crossed behind his head to leaning forward, elbows on knees, and finally back to lying on his side, cocked up on one elbow, as if all these postures were elements of a formal round. His eyes scarcely ever left the girl. She lay absolutely still. Sleep had taken her somewhere else and left only her body behind. Simply lying there, both of them, lying there. She had escaped him. He rose, went to his suitcase and took out the rolled-up shirt, and went back to stand beside his bed. He held the shirt by the collar and let gravity carry the hunting knife to the bed, unrolling the shirt as it fell. When it hit the bed, it was too heavy to bounce. Wanderley picked it up and hefted it. Holding the knife once again behind his back, he shook the girl's shoulder. Her features seemed to blur before she turned over and dug her face into the pillow. He grasped her shoulder again and felt the long, thin bone, the prominent wing jutting out from her back.
"Go away,"
she muttered into the pillow.
"No, we're going to talk."
"It's too late."
He shook her, and when she did not respond, tried to roll her over by force. Thin and small as she was strong enough to resist. He could not make her face him. Then she turned over by herself as if in contempt. Lack of sleep showed in her face, but beneath the puffiness she looked adult.
"What's your name?"
"Angie,"
she smiled carelessly.
"Angie Mall."
"Where do you come from?"
"You know,"
he nodded.
"What were your parents' names?"
"I don't know."
"Who took care of you before I picked you up?"
"It doesn't matter."
"Why not?"
"They aren't important. They were just people."
"Was their name Maul?"
Her smile became more insolent.
"Does it matter? You think you know everything anyhow."
"What do you mean? They were just people."
"They were just people named Mitchell, that's all."
"And you changed your name yourself?"
"So what?"
"I don't know."
That was true. So they looked at one another, he sitting on the edge of the bed, holding the knife behind him and knowing that whatever was going to happen, he would be unable to use it. He supposed that David, too, had been unable to take life, any life but his own, if
he had done that. The girl probably knew he was holding the knife, he thought, and simply dismissed it as a threat. It was not a threat. He, too, was probably not a threat. She had never been even apprehensive of him. "Okay, let's try again," he said. "What are you?" For the first time since he had taken her into the car, she really smiled. It was a transformation, but not of a kind to make him feel easier. She did not look any less adult.
"You know," she said.
He insisted, "What are you?" She smiled all through her amazing response.
"I am you."
"No, I am me. You are you."
"I am you."
"What are you?" It came out in despair, and it did not mean what he had meant the first time he asked it. Then, just for a second, he was back on the street in New York, and the person before him was not the stylish, suntanned, anonymous woman, but his brother David. His face crumbled and his body dressed in the torn and rotting clothing of the grave. The most dreadful thing. Part 1. After Jaffrey's Party. Don't the moon look lonesome shining through the trees? Don't the moon look lonesome shining through the trees? Blues. Chapter 1. The Chowder Society. The October Stories. America's first fictional heroes were old men. Robert Ferguson. Milburn observed through nostalgia. One day early in October, Frederick Hawthorne, a 70-year-old lawyer who had lost very little to the years, left his house on Melrose Avenue in Milburn, New York, to walk across town to his offices on Wheat Row, just beside the square. The temperature was a little colder than Milburn expected so early in its autumn, but Ricky wore his winter uniform of tweed topcoat, cashmere muffler, and gray no-nonsense hat. He walked a little briskly down Melrose Avenue to warm up his blood, moving beneath huge oaks and smaller maples, already colored heart-wrenching shades of orange and red, another unseasonal touch. He was susceptible to colds, and if the temperature dropped another 5 degrees, he'd have to drive. But in the meantime, as long as he could keep the wind from his neck, he enjoyed the walk. After he had turned out of Melrose Avenue toward the square, he was warm enough to go at a more leisurely pace. Ricky had little reason to rush to his office. Clients rarely appeared before noon. His partner and friend, Sears James, probably would not appear for another 45 minutes, and that gave Ricky enough time to amble through Milburn, saying hello to people and observing the things he liked to observe. What he chiefly liked to observe was Milburn itself. Milburn, the town in which all of his life except for his time in university, law school, and the army had been spent. He had never wanted to live anywhere else, though in the early days of his marriage, his lovely and restless wife had often claimed that the town was boring. Stella had wanted New York, had wanted it resolutely. That had been one of the battles he had won. It was incomprehensible to Ricky that anyone could find Milburn boring. If you watched it closely for 70 years, you saw the century at work. Ricky imagined that if you watched New York for the same period, what you saw would be mainly New York at work. Buildings went up and down too fast there for Ricky's taste. Everything moved too quickly, wrapped in a self-absorbed cocoon of energy, whirling too fast to notice anything west of the Hudson but the Jersey lights. Also, New York had a couple of 100,000 lawyers. Milburn had only 5 or 6 that counted, and he and Sears had been for 40 years the most prominent of these.
not that Stella had ever cared a whit about Milburn's notions of prominence. He entered the business district, which lay along two blocks west of the square, and continued for two blocks along the other side, past Clark Mulligan's Rialto Theater, and paused to look at the marquee. What he saw there made him wrinkle his nose. The posters on the front of the Rialto showed the blood-streaked face of a girl. The kind of movies Ricky liked could now be seen only on television. For Ricky, the film industry had lost its bearings about the time William Powell had retired. He thought that Clark Mulligan probably agreed with him. Too many modern films were like his dreams, which had become particularly vivid during the last year. Ricky turned dismissively away from the theater and faced a prospect far more pleasing. The original high-frame houses of Milburn had endured, even if nearly all of them were now office buildings. Even the trees were younger than the buildings. He walked, his polished black shoes kicking through crisp leaves, past buildings much like those on Wheat Row, and accompanied memories of his boyhood self down these same streets. He was smiling, and if any of the people he greeted had asked him what he was thinking about, he might, if he allowed himself to be so pompous, have said, "Why, sidewalks? I've been thinking about sidewalks. One of my earliest memories is of the time they put in the sidewalks along the whole stretch of Candlemaker Street here, right down to the square, hauling those big blocks up with horses. You know, sidewalks made a greater contribution to civilization than the piston engine. Spring and winter in the old days, you had to wade through mud, and you couldn't enter a drawing room without tracking some of it in. Summers, the dust was everywhere." Of course, he reflected, drawing rooms had gone out just about the time the sidewalks had come in. When he reached the square, he found another unhappy surprise. Some of the trees lining the big grassy space were already completely bare, and most of the others had at least a few bare limbs. There was still plenty of the color he'd been anticipating, but during the night the balance had turned, and now black skeletal arms and fingers, the bones of the trees, hung against the leaves like signposts to winter. Dead leaves carpeted the square. "Hi, Mr. Hawthorne," someone beside him said. He turned and saw Peter Barnes, a high school senior, whose father, 20 years younger than Ricky, was in the second periphery of his friends. The first circle consisted of four men his own age. There had been five, but Edward Wanderley had died almost a year earlier. More somberness, when he was determined not to be somber. "Hello, Peter," he said. "You must be on your way to school. It starts an hour late today. The heaters broke again." Peter Barnes stood beside him, a tall, amiable-looking boy in a ski sweater and jeans. His black hair seemed almost girlishly long to Ricky, but the width of his shoulders promised that when he started to fill out, he would be a much bigger man than his father. Presumably his hair didn't look girlish to girls.
"Just walking around?"
"That's right," Peter said. "Sometimes it's fun just to walk around town and look at things." Ricky nearly beamed.
"Why, that's right. I feel exactly the same thing myself. I always enjoy my walks across town. The strangest things pop into my head. I was just thinking that sidewalks changed the world. They made everything much more civilized."
"Oh," said Peter, looking at him curiously.
"I know, I know. I told you strange things occur to me. Heavens. How is Walter these days?"
"He's fine. He's at the bank now."